we're going to be starting here, so I'm saying this for the purposes of the tape. We can start the tape. I'm Jim DeLang. I'm a pastor of St. Francis Lutheran Church in the heart of San Francisco. It's a century-old congregation that has undergone a transformation in the last 25 years or so and is experiencing some revitalization. Our ministry there is with the gay community, which about 20% or so of San Francisco's population is probably gay or lesbian. 20% of the population is elderly, or people over 65, and a large number of those over 75. And the rest, of course, are a mixture of numbers of people. So those of you who've visited San Francisco are probably aware of wherever you go why there's all this variety of people from all over the country, or all over the world, I mean, and different languages and so on. I've been the pastor there for 7 years. Prior to that, I had a staff position with the Synod, and prior to that I served a suburban congregation in Southern California, which was mostly traditional families. I am no expert on the homeless. I want to say that up front. Although we have the homeless at our door every day, and sometimes a couple of times a day, and our people where they work and so on like this are constantly confronted with the problem, and so I am somewhat up to date because I've been forced to get up to date as to what the issues are and what's involved. And we did a study in February in our congregation in which we had people from the mayor's office come out and tell us about the problem, some of the causes, and so on like this. And so what I'm sharing with you today is based on that information that I have, plus two articles, which I will provide the bulk of my material. One is a book that is just out called Rachel and Her Children by Jonathan Kozol, who wrote, he was the author of Illiterate America, and how the problem of illiteracy. And the other is an article by Peter Marin that appeared in Harper's Magazine within the last year and has been republished in the Utney Reader and a few other places. Peter Marin is writing a book on the homeless and has a sensitivity to it because he was once a transient himself. He's a professor at the University of Santa Barbara, University of California, Santa Barbara. Let's just begin by kind of reviewing where we're going to go. We're going to talk about how many, very briefly, who are the homeless and why there are so many, why it's going to get worse, and our reaction to the homeless, and finally what we can do. So hopefully we'll get to all those places and be able to have some time for questions as well. Let's see what we can do. Let me begin by reading a story from Rachel and Her Children, which is the introduction really to Jonathan Kozol's book. He was a carpenter. She was a woman many people nowadays would call old-fashioned. She kept house and cared for their five children while he did construction work in New York City housing projects. Their home was an apartment in a row of neat brick buildings. She was very pretty then, and even now, worn down by months of suffering, she has a lovely, wistful look. She wears blue jeans, a yellow jersey, and a bright red ribbon in her hair. For luck, she says. But luck has not been with this family for some time. They were a happy and chaotic family then. He was proud of his acquired skills. I did carpentry. I painted. I could do wallpapering. I earned a living. We spent Sundays walking with our children at the beach. They lived near Coney Island. And that is where this story will begin. We were at the boardwalk. We were up some. We had been at Nathan's. We were eating hot dogs. He's cheerful when he recollects this afternoon. The children have long, unruly hair. They range in age from 2 to 10. They crawl all over him, exuberant and wild. Peter says that they were wearing summer clothes, shorts and sneakers. Everybody was in shorts. When they were told about the fire, They grabbed the children and ran home. Everything they owned had been destroyed. My grandmother's china, she says, everything. And she adds, I had that book of gourmet cooking. What did the children lose? My doggie, says one child. Her kitten, born 3 days before, had also died. Peter has not had a real job since. Not since the fire. I had tools. I can't replace those tools. It took me years. He explains he had accumulated tools for different jobs, one tool at a time. Each job would enable him to add another tool to his collection. Everything I had was in that fire. They had never turned to welfare in the 12 years since they'd met and married. A social worker helped to place them in a homeless shelter called the Martinique Hotel. When we meet, Peter is 30, Megan is 28. They have been in this hotel 2 years. She explains why they cannot get out. Welfare tells you how much you can spend for an apartment. The limit for our family is $366. Try to find a place for seven people for $366 in New York City. You can't do it. I've been looking for 2 years. The city pays $3,000 monthly for the two connected rooms in which they live. She shows me the bathroom. Crumbling walls, broken tiles, the toilet doesn't work. There is a pan to catch something that's dripping from the plaster. The smell is overpowering. I don't see any way out, he says. I want to go home. Where can I go? A year later, I'm in New York, in front of a Park Avenue hotel. I'm facing two panhandlers. It takes a moment before I can recall their names. They look quite different now. The panic I saw in them a year ago is gone. All five children have been taken from them. Having nothing left to lose has drained them of their desperation. The children have been scattered, placed in various foster homes. White children, Peter says, are in demand by adoption agencies. Standing here before a beautiful hotel as evening settles in over New York, I'm reminded of the time before the fire when they had their children and she had her cookbooks and their children had a dog and a cat. I remember the words Peter used. We were up some. We had been at Nathan's. Although I am not a New Yorker, I know by now what Nathan's is, a hot dog stand. The other phrase has never left my mind. Up some? Peter laughs. The laughter stops. Beneath his streetwise manner, he is not a hardened man at all. It means, he says, that we were happy. How many people are homeless in the United States? The official government figures say there are 350,000. The U.S. Conference of Mayors, which did a study, estimates that there are closer to 3 million. And the testimony that HUD made before Congress was discredited by the staff people in Congress, of congressmen on the book, or that were doing the study. Of the 3 million people that are homeless, it's estimated that 500,000, or 500,000, are children. Homelessness is not confined to major cities like New York and San Francisco and Chicago. If you go to any medium-sized city in the United States today, you find homeless people. Sometimes in some of our very nice suburbs and areas, which we call. One of the members of our church got one of these go-around-the-country Greyhound passes. You can go all around, And he traveled for 4 months, and he said in every city they pulled in, the homeless were. The numbers are increasing at such a rapid rate that by the year 2000, that's just 12 years from now, it's estimated that the numbers will go from 3 million to 18 million homeless. And the reason for that, we're going to talk about a little bit later, but when we discover, why it's going to get worse, when we take up that issue. But at the present time, whatever the numbers, there is general agreement with this 1987 study by the Conference of Mayors that the homeless can be categorized in these general areas. First of all, there are the Vietnam veterans, and they constitute about 50% of the homeless. The mentally ill constitute about 20%, and families who have been pauperized, like Peter and Michelle, I forgot what her name was, they are the fastest growing, and they constitute 25%. The rest, the elderly on fixed incomes that are insufficient, runaway children that have usually been abused, alcohol and drug abusers that aren't included in these above three categories, immigrants, illegal and illegal, who have not been able to make it, the physically and chronically ill, and then the traditional hobos and tranchants, people who just make a decision that they want to live that way and don't have alcohol and drug problems, but just choose to live that way. This constitutes the other 5%. So that the majority, as you can see, fall in this category here. And you ask about who are the homeless. From this list, you can quickly ascertain two things. There are those people who have had homelessness forced upon them because of circumstances in their lives, of one sort or another, and then there are those who are homeless by choice. Now, I recognize the danger of bringing in the whole concept of choice into a discussion on the homeless, because it's a way that we can, I guess you might say, can become indifferent to the problem. But you can also learn from this list that the people who are homeless are very much like ourselves. They're not that much different than ourselves before they were homeless. And you can also learn that the reason that people are homeless is because of various policies, various decisions that we have made as a people, that some of us have even profited from. For example, we decide as a people to go to war, and years later, we ask our young men to go and to kill and to die. And the result of that years later is grown men on the street who are homeless. We change with the best of intentions our policies toward the mentally ill. And we change the laws and without intention neglect to provide for the results of that. And the result is years later is people on the streets who drive us crazy because of the way that they act. We cut taxes and we prune budgets. We modernize industry and we shift the balance of trade. And the result of these actions and errors are visible on the streets. The liberals cannot blame the conservatives, much as they would like to. And the conservatives cannot blame the liberals. Homelessness is the sum total of our expectations, of our dreams, of our policies, of our decisions, all visible in flesh on the streets. As I said, you can also learn from this list that there are some folks who have chosen to be homeless. But while it is dangerous to bring that into the discussion, it is also, I think, by taking choice into account that we can only understand certain kinds of homelessness. Take, for example, the Vietnam veterans. Some of the Vietnam veterans came back from the war severely damaged. Some were able to handle it, but many were not. And the result was alcoholism, divorce, a walking away, if you will, from what it is that we Americans have kind of made as a kind of a social contract. And they have said, I can't participate in that social contract with America to work and to do. I can't handle it. I can't do it. And so the best that they can manage, the best that they can manage is a life on the streets and to drink, because maybe that is what they can handle, because what they fear most is destroying someone else or themselves. I guess we have to learn to accept the fact that there may indeed be people, and not only veterans, who have seen so much of the world and seen it in such stark and awful terms that to live in it is just impossible. Let me read you the story of Alice. Alice is a middle-aged woman who lives in Los Angeles, one of 50,000 homeless people. And she was a woman who was interviewed by a student at the University of Santa Barbara by Peter Marin, who was taught by Peter Marin, and asked to go out and talk to the homeless and get to hear their stories. And so one day, this student saw Alice foraging in a dumpster outside of a McDonald's, and this is her story. She told me she had a pretty normal life as she grew up and eventually went to college. From there, she went on to Chicago to teach school. She was single and lived in a small apartment. One night after she got off the train after school, a man began to follow her to her apartment building. When she got to her door, she saw a knife and the man hovering behind her. She had no choice but to let him in. The man raped her. After that, things got steadily worse. She had a nervous breakdown. She went to a mental institution for 3 months, and when she went back to her apartment, she found her belongings gone. The landlord had sold them to cover the rent she hadn't paid. She had no place to go and no job because the school had terminated her employment. She slipped into depression. She lived with friends until she could muster enough money for a ticket to Los Angeles. She said she no longer wanted to burden her friends, and that if she had to live outside, at least Los Angeles was warmer than Chicago. It is as if she began then to take on the mentality of a street person. She resolved herself to homelessness. She's been out west since 1980, without a home or job. She seems happy, with her best friend being her cat. But the scars of memories still haunt her, and she is running from them, or I should say, him. This, in essence, is the story one hears over and over again on the street from people. And it really is, I think, something when you hear these stories that is absolutely unique in American life, is that this country, which prides itself on being the greatest country in the world, somehow in this whole mix, we don't have a place for people like this. We can we look at people like Alice, and we can talk about it as a failure of will or a failure of character. But what we don't see is that perhaps the world that Alice has created for herself is better in her terms. It's kind of a self-imposed exile, where some people have had things happen to them that are so overwhelming that they cannot fulfill the social contract that we all make with one another. And so they, in effect, tear it up or turn it in. We wonder why it is in our country that there aren't some family structures or some social structures, or, you know, there ought to be some kind of an agency or something like that to take care of these people. And the fact is that there aren't in every case. And some people do not have families, or they have families who are so marginal themselves that they can't do it. We also like to think in America that everything is redeemable, that everything broken can be magically made whole again, and that what can be dirty can be dirty, what is dirty can be cleansed. And that's true. Many of those who have suffered, like Alice and like Peter and Megan and their family, you can sometimes. All you have to do sometimes with folks that are, what you might say, down and out or out on their luck, is kind of read their stories backward and find out just when it fell apart. In the case of Peter and Megan, and then try to get them on their feet again, if not too much time has passed. But how would you put back together the life of somebody like Alice, where she would be back in a classroom teaching again and in her apartment? We have to recognize that there are some people, in other words, who are homeless because they have torn up the social contract with America. Okay, on who the homeless are. Let's see. Why are there so many homeless? That's where we are now, right? Why are there so many? We have to remember the immensity of the changes that have occurred in our cities over the last couple of decades. It used to be that every city had a skid row where there were cheap hotels, hash houses, and most importantly, occasional jobs, where you could get a couple of days' work. There was the Bowery in New York. There was the Old Embarcadero in San Francisco, the waterfront in Seattle. Every city had that, Old Town in Sacramento. But what has happened in the last couple of decades is that something called urban renewal. And we have gone into these places and torn down these hotels and these hash houses and put up office buildings and office parks and condominiums, high-priced condominiums. And as a result, a lot of the housing that used to take care of people who were living on the margins is no longer exists. It was not a wonderful world, but it was a world. You could survive there. But that is gone. Then into this marginal world, there more people have poured in. In the 60s, there were the counterculture children, the hippies and so on like this, that fled in or dropped in with their drug dropouts. They dropped in to it with their drugs, is what I'm trying to say. And then we made changes in the law regarding the mentally ill. And with the best of intentions, while we changed the laws, in 1963, President Kennedy said in a speech, he said this. Let me see if I can find it. Yeah, here it is. Reliance on the cold mercy of custodial isolation will be supplanted by the open warmth of community concern. But it never happened. The population in our mental hospitals went from 560,000 in 1955 to today, it is 130,000. So, plus increased numbers, of course, of schizophrenics and so on like that. So the first there were the dropouts and the druggies, and then the mentally ill were released, and then in the 70s came the Vietnam vets. In the 80s, we had a recession. Remember when unemployment was up to 12-13%, like that? And into that world, then in the early 80s, also came a whole group of people who never thought that they would be there. At the same time, the price of housing went up, and there were further and further restrictions made on people, on developers and so on, who wanted to build housing. And so some developers said, I'm not even, you know, I have to go through so much red tape, I'm not even going to even try to build in that area. And then the interest rates went up. Well, what happens then is that rents skyrocket and homes go way up, and people start moving down, you know, as to what they can afford. So people that would normally have lived in a three-bedroom apartment, you know, with two baths and so on, I guess, say, well, maybe we're going to have to lower our sights, and they'll go down to a two-bedroom apartment. And it keeps going down, and finally somebody gets squeezed out of the street, because as you start squeezing this housing market out, so somebody is finally, you know, can't afford anything, because even the cheapo apartments, the cheapest flop houses, suddenly become unaffordable to people. Give you an example. In San Francisco, we lost 5,000 units of low-income housing in the last 5 years, last 10 years.
Is that urban renewal? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, from urban renewal, yeah. You know, and the alcoholics who once used to drink themselves, you know, to sleep, and then in their rooms, while they're out on the streets. And that's basically, you know, what has happened. Now, another reason that we have this problem is because of United States government policy. Let me read something here about this. Since 1980, the White House has virtually cut all federal funds to build or rehabilitate low-income housing. In 1986, there were 25,000 units of low-income housing built in the United States. During the 2 years of the Ford administration, Gerald Ford's administration, there were 200,000 units built. And in the 4 years of President Carter's administration, there were 300,000 built. There has been the federal subsidy for low-income housing. In other words, people get, Title VIII, I think it is, they get money for housing. For example, if I own an apartment building and the market for this two-bedroom apartment is $700 a month, and this person, according to their income, can only afford $400 a month, then the government makes up the difference. That's a subsidy program, how that works. That program has been cut between 1981 and 1986 from $28 billion to $9 billion. Two-thirds cut in that program. An HUD Deputy Assistant Secretary in 1985, in testimony before Congress, said that we're getting out of the housing business, period. The federal government is getting out, period. When he was asked by a congressman where these people were going to go, he says, I suggest that they find another place to live. Where did the lumber workers go? I met some of them that same night in a homeless shelter by the Burnside Bridge. A pregnant woman and her husband spoke to me while waiting for the soup line to be formed. We had good work until last year. Since then, we've had no home. Our kids were put in foster care. They had been sleeping on a plywood plank supported by the girders of the bridge. The traffic was 2 feet above their heads. Okay, where do we go next here? Okay, all of these factors that we've talked about are what pushed people on the economic margins, but that really isn't the cause of homelessness. The cause of homelessness basically is the lack of affordable housing. There just aren't enough places for people to live. Cheaply enough to be able to survive. It's that simple. And when people are out on the street, Well, put yourself in the position. I don't know if you've ever traveled and gone somewhere and where you thought you had hotel reservations and they didn't have them. Sorry, we're full. Where will I go? I don't know. And there's that moment of panic. You know, where am I going to sleep? Where am I going to brush my teeth? Where am I going to hang up my clothes? Where am I going to put my stuff that I've got with me? Remember that movie a few years ago with Jack Lemmon and Sandy Dennis? Huh, what was it?
Out-of-Towners.
Out-of-Towners, they went to New York. It was an indictment of New York. But and they got robbed and everything else like this. And that's a kind of panic. And so it is that when people become homeless, they panic, and then after a while, it becomes a way of life. And then when you go to apply for a job, of course, you say, well, put down what's your address and phone number. You have to have a home. You have to have a home to apply for a job. So you have to have an address. Okay. Why is the problem going to get worse? This is an article in Newsweek from last August, a new squeeze on housing. And the new squeeze on housing is caused by a couple of factors. But for one thing, there's about 10 million families that are living on the edge right now. And by on the edge, it means that half of their income is going for housing. And there are about 4.7 million, and where 60% of their income is going for housing. So all you have to have is a little bit of an increase in the price of food. You know, and these people are not going to be able to pay their rent, and then they're going to be out on the street. And that's likely to happen with the drought this year. We might see some real increase in the stores in the next year. As far as the price of food is concerned. But the other reason is that over the next 10 years, more than 500,000 low and moderate income families may be evicted from subsidized, federally subsidized apartment buildings. And the reason is that 10 and 20 years ago, during the war on poverty, the government made a deal with developers. If you build these apartment buildings, we'll give you financing, tax breaks, low interest financing like this, as long as you rent them for low and moderate income people. And if you do that for 20 years, then you can take them back. Well, that's come and due. And that's what's happening. Representative Joseph Kennedy, Massachusetts, has introduced some legislation on this, but his office estimates that 57% of low-income housing is in that category. 57%. In California, one of our legislators estimates that there are 70,000 apartments California that fall in that category. So that's why the problem is going to get worse. Okay. Let's talk about our reaction a little bit to the homeless. Our reaction to the homeless is fed by a complex set of attitudes and responses that are so ingrained in us, they're like second nature. The homeless embody all that you and I and our parents and grandparents have tried to eradicate from American society. Here's, for example, a part of a paper a college student wrote after a visit to Skid Row. To a rescue mission. The sermon began. The room was stuffy and smelly. The mixture of body odors and cooking was nauseating. I remember thinking, how can these people share this facility? They must be repulsed by each other. They had strange habits and bad dispositions. They were a group of dirty, weird people to me. When it was over, I ran to my car, went home, and took a shower. I felt extremely dirty. Through the rest of that day, I would get flashes of that disgusting smell. As Peter Marin puts it in his article in Harper's, he says, what the homeless represent to us is shit. He said, all of our feelings about excrement and toilet training and all of that that we went through ourselves are bound up in our feelings about the homeless. And he says that is why he says that hidden behind every policy and every plan to help the homeless, and why it so often does more harm than good, is because most of the programs are designed to help those who are doing the helping rather than the homeless themselves. They're designed to make us feel better rather than the homeless. That those who are giving help are the ones who are being served by this legislation rather than the homeless. So what it is we want, that's why we have the shelters. We want the homeless out of sight, where we don't have to see them or smell them. We want to get them out, get rid of them. So it's just like you want to flush excrement down the toilet and get it out of the way. And that's why if you are a homeless person, you go to any government agency or any private charity for that matter, and you will find yourself at once enmeshed in a bureaucracy and red tape that is so oppressive and an attitude that is so morally superior that you want to run out into the street for relief. And why when people come to our door and you say, have you been such and such, they just go like that. They've been through it. One of Lily Tomlin's characters, Trudy the bag lady, you know, she wears an umbrella hat, which she uses as a satellite to communicate with her friends in outer space. She calls her space chums. And Trudy says, you know, my studies have shown that reality is the greatest cause of stress by those who are forced to deal with it. She says, I can take reality in small doses, but as a lifestyle, I find it too oppressive. Well, in a world better than ours, we imagine that homeless men, women, and children do not exist. Doctrinaire conservatives seem to have no trouble imagining a society so well-disciplined that things, and moral, that things like homelessness would just disappear. Doctrinaire liberals envision a world so just, so generous, so egalitarian that things like homelessness would just vanish along with all other inequities. But neither a conservative revolution nor a workers' paradise is on the horizon. Few of us believe that either one would solve these problems. Meanwhile, we are appalled not only by what is happening to the homeless, but by what is happening to us. 30 years ago, if you saw somebody laying in the street, you went over and helped them. Now when you see them, you step over them. They live there. And it is really, really, really bad. Let me read you something that a guy wrote, a columnist in Newsweek. I don't think it was George Will, but it sounds like George Will. And he says, I'm about to be heartless. There are people living on the streets, turning sidewalks into dormitories. They are a nightmare. They have got to go. The author notes then that his taxes pay for the paving and cleaning of the sidewalk that they call home. That makes me their landlord, he says. They have got to go. The city with its army of great dwellers is a school for callousness. Our natural instincts to help are suppressed every day. Moreover, they have to be suppressed if one is to function. Trying to get a homeless person out of his cardboard box is not a simple act of mercy of which most people are quite capable. It is a major act of social work. Ordinary citizens should not be required to make a choice between being Mother Teresa and ignoring the homeless. A civilized society ought to offer its people some communal act that lies somewhere in between, such as contributing to the public treasury to care for these people. There is a very fine article written in the New Republic by Charles Krauthammer, which was talked about housing the homeless mentally ill. And if you might want to read, that was in February of this year. Furthermore, he says to expect saintliness of the ordinary citizen is bad social policy. Further, to expose us hourly to a wretchedness far beyond power to remedy, is to make moral insensitivity a requirement for daily living. Society must not leave the ordinary citizen with no alternative between ignoring the homeless and playing Mother Teresa. A civilized society ought to offer its people some communal act that lies somewhere in between, such as contributing to the public treasury to build housing and a system to care for these people. Jesus told us, I was hungry and you fed me, I was naked and you clothed me, I was a stranger and you took me in. I don't think that there's any person in our churches who doesn't want to do something about this, but we really feel helpless. I think there are some specific things that we can do. For one thing is, I think we can stop blaming the homeless for their plight, that somehow or another they haven't worked hard enough or they haven't planned well enough or whatever it is. And we can stop blaming ourselves and we can stop blaming Ronald Reagan, because it is the sum total of all kinds of things that have been done by us, by the generation before us, of the current, that caused the current problem. We need to work hand in hand with those agencies that are knowledgeable about the homeless situation. Organizations such as Catholic Charities, in some cities, Lutheran Social Services, and so on. These people who are advocates for the homeless. And for some of the homeless, obviously, all we have to do is read their stories backwards and try to get them on their feet again. Another thing we can do is that we can give the homeless an address. They can have the address of our church, as we have done sometimes. They put out a job application. We can have them use the phone number of our home, if we would, when they put it on a job application, and when the employer, prospective employer, calls. We can have a prearranged time to call this homeless person at a payphone where they can get their messages. If we have a room in our home, we can, with careful screening, because there are some real weirdos out there, take in a homeless family, and we should not do the screening. We should have work with a responsible agency on doing that knows the people. But all of that is not going to address the basic problem, which is the lack of affordable housing. And I think this is going to require a massive effort by the next administration, whichever administration that is, and by a cooperation between the real estate interests, developers, government, and advocates for the homeless and low-income people. But somebody ultimately is going to have to pay for it. And usually the burden of paying for something like this is going to fall upon those of us who are working, and in the way of taxes. Or perhaps we can scrap a few weapon systems, maybe a couple of Trident submarines to take care of it. Okay, questions?
What does countries in Europe, we talked about our policies, mm-hmm. What are some of the policies that are done in some of the European countries to handle this? Are they have similar homeless type of situations?
Did you see the one on Russia that showed the homeless there? It surprised me.
I really don't know.
It was really enlightening. They have just a problem like we have.
Yep.
But they never show it. But
yeah. The only thing is that in the Soviet Union, the family structure is a little more solid than it is in our society. I mean, that's what I've observed, And in the European countries, like the Scandinavian countries and Germany, while you sometimes have to wait a while for the housing you want, but there is some kind of housing. Is that right? Anybody know?
Well, aren't there a lot of multi-family housing? I mean, people are living generations together.
Yeah. Which we used to do in this country.
And that's why the Victorian homes were built. The Victorian homes were built to house three generations. There are little bedrooms and so on. But we destroyed most of those structures. Yeah.
I can give an example of part of the homeless, kind of a difference between some of the countries in our country. It's an area that I've studied, and I would add to the homeless people who have been in prison.
Been in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then come out. In our country, we have most of the people in institutions, large institutions, that are away from the public and isolated. And typically, the people available to the people in prison are families that are directly related, no one else. We have, I'd say probably about 6-7 years ago, there was a program started that tried to bring the prisoners closer to an environment that would enable them to meet other people other than their old cronies when they got out, because the old cronies brought them right back to prison. In Europe, for example, in the Scandinavian countries in particular, one of the things that they've done is that they've taken the idea of the huge institution that isolates those people from the rest of society, and taking those people out into the communities, the idea is quite a bit different than ours, even now, I think. The idea is to minimize the stay in prison, and also to get the people who are in prison back into society as quickly as possible by integrating them into environments where they can meet people and work with people like you and I. And they do that by actually taking them the prison and putting it within, I don't know what towns you're from, but there would be prisons all over the place instead of in great big institutions.
Yeah.
And work programs for those people.
Yeah, we have, I think it's 500,000, aren't there 500,000 people in prison in the United States?
Yes. Yeah,
something like that?
Very large.
Very large. Usually in these very large institutions. So. Really dehumanizing. I'm board of directors of a chapter of Friends Outside, which is an organization that assists families and people who are coming out of prison with job training and so on like this. But we just get assist families of people who are incarcerated. Yes.
I don't want to make this sound more depressing than it is, but my observation is what you said too. Low-income housing, I don't think it's going to solve the problem. Because if you look at this list of people who are homeless, nobody on that list is really in a position to make good decisions. Even if the housing is there, who is going to explain to them how to find it?
This number here, it'll help these people here, which is the fastest growing.
But even those people are in the midst of a trauma of some kind or another for a period of time, even if it's short term.
Right.
It looks like this is a whole list of all of our social problems. The homelessness is just a symptom of a whole string of problems.
That's right. And what Peter Moran argues is that for some people, we like to think that that everybody is somehow redeemable. And what we have to maybe come to grips with is that some folks are too far gone. I mean, their life has been like Alice. Has been so traumatized that there's no turning back. And the best that we can do as a society is provide a place for them to live, for some space for them to move and live with freedom and a certain element of self-dignity. Instead of tearing down their neighborhoods, or, if you will, and throwing them in jail, making them criminals. And the same may be true with the Vietnam vets, although gratified to hear that we're going to have a cabinet level position for veterans. Mm-hmm. Kind of dealing with the problem. There might be some hope that something might, through that process makes it. Bob?
Just for the rest of the people here, we've known Jim because we're members of his parish in Huntington Beach a long time ago. You really disappoint me. I thought, isn't the name Alice also the name that Gary Trudeau used in the cartoons? In the routine, he introduced me to Gary Trudeau. I'd never even read the man until tonight we had a conference. Do you remember the cartoon series that he did? Or he really went after homeless about a year ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this gal.
This is Doonesbury.
Yeah, the gal who lived over the grates and knew where the better, warmer.
That was in Washington, D.C. Yeah. She was in Washington.
Didn't you give her the name Alice?
I think you did, yes.
She kept calling everybody ducks.
Yeah. This. I'm sorry. This is. My natural inclinations toward humor kind of disappear when I talk
about this. Trudeau could say the whole thing about homeless and about our incapacity to love or whatever that is, but it was just a simple few lines and a couple of words.
I heard the bell ring, but if anybody else got any more questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
It seems to me we do a lot of describing and observing and writing books and all these things, but nothing really gets accomplished or changed.
Well, that's what I suggest, is that there are in every city, there's some advocacy group of people dealing with the homeless. And the thing is that you need to join forces with them. That's what we can do on an individual basis. The churches should not, you know, say, well, we're going to open our parish hall for homeless people. Without knowing what they're getting into, because some of our churches have done that.
There's a church in Portland doing it very successfully.
Yeah. You need to know what you're doing when you're going to do something like that.
Yes. I think it's sometimes a case of individuals like us. We don't know any homeless. We don't know how to go about helping them. But we had an example in Salem, Oregon, where I'm from. And one winter day at lunch hour, he was standing on the street, poorly dressed but clean, and he had a sign hanging around his neck. He said, "My name is Bruce. I'm decent and honest. I need a job. I have a family. Please help me." And people walked up and gave him gloves, a cup of coffee, money, and the story was written up in the paper, and he had two or three job offers, so he helped himself out of homelessness.
Yeah, but there are, in some cities, you know, some cities there are hundreds of people like that. Most of the people who come to my door and ask for money, it's a con. They want money for drugs or booze. That's what they want. Yeah. They always got some story, you know. And when you say, "Well, let me check," and I want to check that out, well, you say, "Well, forget it. You're not going to help me." What would Jesus do? As they say, they're going cursing me, trying to play a trick.
Go live among them is what he'd do.
Yeah. And some of our pastors do. You know, some of our churches do.
I was going to say that we don't have the problem right in our area. Of our home parish, but what we've done is kind of aligned ourselves with an inner city parish in Denver, and we go a sister congregation relationship. We send clothes and food down there, and those people down there are right in the midst of it. They have training to recognize the cons and the real needy ones. And they're basically the distribution center, but they're poor themselves. So
yeah.
You know, they need the help and they do the work. So I think some of these relationships can help out.
Yeah, I think that's you know, many of those things. I mean, like what we do. I mean, we volunteers go down to St. Anthony's Kitchen, you know, something like this, and work for Saturday. But that's just a, you know, finger in the die kind of thing. There has to be a major change in policy at the highest levels of government, because we're talking about billions of dollars to build housing. Okay.
Those changes only come from groups of people like this.
Yeah, they only come from people rising up. So, okay, thank you.
Thank you.